This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with a Bay Area guy. We're going to be talking about healthcare and Donald Trump and the recently failed proposed healthcare bill. Bay Area guy, it's great having you back on the show.
As always, it's a pleasure to be on.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Pillator.
Nice talking to you, Bay Area guy.
Yep, always good to converse.
So, to start things off, you had a recent post healthcare in the Donald, and you talk about the demise of the Republican healthcare bill and its implications for Trump. This was pretty much Paul Ryan's bill, and
right.
This was Paul Ryan's bill, and then Trump went along and supported it. We can kind of speculate what Trump's motivation was. Some people are saying Trump is just another corporate shill. Some people are saying he was obligated to do it because he had to appease the Republicans in Congress, and he needed Paul Ryan's support for his own projects. But either way, I mean, a lot of people are very disappointed with Trump. And out of all the people we're talking about, I mean, you never actually supported Trump. I mean, both Pillator and I did support Trump, but you never supported him.
I did not, because as I mentioned in that post that I linked to, I always regarded him as a billionaire plutocrat. And yes, he does piss off liberals, and yes, he has broken various taboos, but at the end of the day, he's a rich Chamber of Commerce kind of Republican, so expecting him to actually push for policies such as single-payer healthcare or enacting other populist laws, I think was a bit naive on the part of some of his supporters, not implicating anyone here, of course.
What do you think his motive was? Do you think that Trump has this strong corporate agenda, or do you think he's doing it for strategic reasons to basically get the support of Republicans in the Congress?
Well, what's kind of ironic is that a lot of Republicans in Congress were actually pressured to oppose the plan. And as a lot of people have mentioned, one of the main reasons why the proposed health care bill died was not so much because of the feeble Democratic so-called resistance, but because of rebellious Republicans. Now, regarding Trump's motives for why he went along with it, I mean, I can only speculate, but I would say that it's sort of a combination of laziness. He doesn't exactly strike me as a policy wonk who wants to delve into the details. And I think he was kind of just going along. But also, on an ideological level, he's someone who favors big business. And one of the things that the proposed policy would have done is that it would have replaced the individual mandate, that is the tax penalty for not having health insurance, with a policy that would have allowed insurance carriers to hike people's premiums by around 30% if they aren't covered but then opt to purchase insurance. So in many ways, it was a huge corporate giveaway.
Yeah, I mean, this obviously was a terrible bill. Whatever you think about Obamacare, I mean, Obamacare has plenty of flaws, and I'm not a supporter of that per se, but this is far worse.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, we're better off keeping Obamacare until we can come up with something better. But the thing is, with Trump's motive, obviously, I mean, Paul Ryan is not a fan of Trump, and he's said some nasty things about him in the primary. And even more recently, and I mean, I read some speculation on a blog post that Paul Ryan put Trump in an awkward position because the people on the Democratic side and the anti-Trump liberals, they're celebrating that the bill failed and it was a failure for Trump. But actually, no, I think this was actually a good thing for Trump that the bill failed, because if it passed, what would happen is Trump would basically alienate all those working class people who voted for him in those Rust Belt states. And he would definitely, I mean, that would pretty much guarantee him to lose the next election. But on the other hand, if Paul Ryan put out this bill and Trump refused to support it, then that would make things very difficult for Trump to work with the Republican Party. So putting aside what a Trump's agenda is, the problem is, even if Trump were this great populist who wanted to do all these great things, it's hard to accomplish anything when you have very, if you just look at the caliber of the Congress, you know, they are.
I mean, no need to really comment on that one, but it's not just the Republicans even. I mean, take the 12 or so Democrats who voted against Bernie Sanders' proposal to allow Americans to purchase cheaper prescription drugs from Canada. So I recognize that passing single-payer health care in a country like the U.S. with its system is no easy task. Nevertheless, I think if Trump could somehow pull it off, he would do a lot to buttress his presidency and enhance his legitimacy.
By pulling it off, are you talking about putting out single payer or just some kind of bill that would make healthcare more affordable? Because he did say that in the primary, that he wanted to negotiate with drug companies to make healthcare more affordable.
Well, by that, I think he means sort of eliminating the antitrust exemptions enjoyed by insurance and big pharma companies. Now, like I said before during one of our previous shows, if he could actually pull that off, I would be thrilled. But I think that single payer would be even better, because polls have shown that around 81% of Democrats and even 41% of Republicans, that is the majority of Americans, favor single-payer health care. And so if he could somehow push that forward, it would really shake things up in both camps for the better, I'd say.
In the past, Donald Trump has came out sympathetic to single-payer health care back in 2015, Eric Erickson, who's famous for saying Trump supporters jerk off to anime, wrote that.
I thought that was Trump. Rick Wilson.
Oh, yeah, you're right, Rick Wilson, but they're basically the same.
They're pretty much the same.
Yeah. Eric Erickson, Redstate.com, that's the one. He said that Trump has supported a Canadian-style universal health care. And then in 1999... when Trump was flirting with running for president under the Reform Party, he told Larry King, this is Trump's quote, "If you can't take care of your sick in the country, forget it. It's all over. I believe in universal health care." And that was in his 2000 book, The America We Deserve. And I've actually read that book a long time ago. He sounds very different, so it's really difficult to know where Trump is coming from. If the problem is Trump or the problem is the Republican Party, and the Republican Party is keeping Trump from being independent. Because just look at the logistics. The Democrats want nothing. Very few Democrats, with the possible exception of some of these centrist red state Democrats like maybe John Tester in Montana or Joe Manchin in West Virginia, but for the most part, the Democratic Party wants nothing to do with him, and the Republican Party is never going to put out anything on these issues that is viable. So basically, even if Trump did want to implement these great things, it's just he's not going to have anyone to support him.
Right, and I recognize that passing bills and producing major policy achievements is quite the arduous task. But one thing the president does have is the bully pulpit. And if Trump were to team up with, say, certain progressives like Bernie Sanders, and Bernie Sanders did say that to the extent that Trump is willing to work to support working families, we will support him. So if Trump were to reach across the aisle to people like Sanders and embrace certain populist measures such as universal health care and browbeat and shame these pro-business Republicans and corporate Democrats for opposing these measures that would improve people's lives. No, he might not achieve a victory right away, but by using that bully pulpit, he could definitely sway the public and improve his own popularity ratings.
Yeah, it would vastly improve his popularity ratings. I mean, even if it didn't pass, it would be a tremendous political realignment because it would split both parties. The Republican Party would split between those who were loyal to him and would just go along and support his proposal, as opposed to the hardcore Chamber of Commerce crowd. Then the Democratic Party would be broken up between those who were truly principled on healthcare and those who just wanted to sort of, they were just hyper-partisans who want to stick it to Trump.
Right, so it would sort of split the Democratic Party between the Tom Perez, Cory Booker types and the Bernie Sanders crowd. And regarding the Chamber of Commerce for Republicans, you did send me an article that Richard Spencer wrote, and I think Spencer, along with other people in the alt-right such as Hunter Wallace, have argued that Trump basically needs to repudiate this Ayn Randian free market libertarian nonsense, because it's important to recognize that these radical Chamber of Commerce libertarian Republicans are a very small minority of the country, and they don't really have much of a natural constituency, which is why they have to latch on to these big party machines in order to wield influence. And I think if Trump could somehow stick it to them, that would be great. But like I said, I'm not really holding my breath on that one.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, Trump is obviously unpredictable. It's really difficult to say what he's going to do. I mean, who knows? We could be pleasantly surprised.
Well, I hope I'm pleasantly surprised. I mean, I was certainly surprised by the entire year of 2016, but I think that Trump, he's not necessarily bought off or intimidated by these special interests, but I think that if only on a subconscious level, he naturally identifies with the interests of business and perhaps sees what's good for business is good for America, the way a lot of other wealthy Republicans do.
What about his trade and protectionist stances?
Well, it's actually interesting that you mentioned that, because I did read an article about how Trump has supposedly renegotiated NAFTA, but one of the provisions actually involves one of the more odious and unpopular aspects of the TPP, that is the ISDS, that is the Investor-State Dispute Settlement, which allows these super international courts, for lack of a better term, to basically impose binding arbitration on nations. So say if a nation wants to, you know, enact environmental laws that cut into a big energy company's profits, then the company can sue sovereign nations. And that's what everyone was warning about with regards to the TPP, but it looks like those provisions are in NAFTA. So even if the TPP doesn't pass, if these onerous requirements are already in place, then it may have all been in vain. And regarding protectionism, I asked about how those workers in Indiana, because early on in Trump's administration, he supposedly saved a bunch of plant workers in Indiana from being laid off, but it turns out they're being laid off anyway. So we'll see if he actually follows through on this.
In the Richard Spencer's article on healthcare, he does say that health insurance is not really insurance in the proper sense of the word, because the concept of insurance as we expect to use it is because insurance is a hedge against foreseen and rare and catastrophic outcomes. But for the leader, it's a bet that the holder won't call in the liability. And that's basically what Richard Spencer points out as the classic insurance scenario.
Right. And health insurance doesn't really fit that scenario because, you know, even the healthiest of people are going to see the doctor at least once or so per year. So it's not a hedge against the unforeseen catastrophe. In fact, if you were to compare, say, auto insurance to health insurance, it would be as if with auto insurance, you could get free routine oil changes and only pay a copay or co-insurance for brake repairs. But auto insurance only protects you against accidents, which you presume will not happen. So health insurance, as Spencer rightly argues, really amounts more to a prepayment or installment plan.
And another point that Richard Spencer made is for a lot of people that are political dissidents, one of the reasons they don't get involved in dissident politics is because they're afraid of losing their health insurance.
Right. And one thing I've actually noticed, and which I think we've all noticed over the past few years, is that a lot of SJWs will use job market. Well, I guess I should rephrase that. They will pressure the employers of so-called offensive people to fire those who espouse politically incorrect offensive views. And you even see SJWs argue that, well, free speech doesn't protect you if a private corporation wants to fire you. And so in many ways, I applaud Spencer's proposal because he's essentially making it easier for Americans to survive and get by without depending on the whims of a private employer who could be pressured by agitators like SJWs.
I was thinking about that weird, I'm thinking of this, I don't know, it seems really strange because I feel like this whole social justice warrior culture is just normative people not understanding what's happening around them, or at least that they're caught up that the rule of the law is basically this phony sense of getting a job, shutting up, and making a 60K income if they can ever do that, but they can't. You know, it's this really strange, like, culture we live through that's very materialistic, and I think a lot of the whole social justice warrior ethics is, I guess, kind of based upon that if you're not a normie, they will purge you, and the normie, according to alt-right standards, is you're a cultural Marxist or something like that, and I feel as though, I was reading this other article from this website. I think it's Eero magazine, and they claim to be post-liberals, or at least liberals that don't like
post-liberals.
They don't like what the left is going on, but they say that, you know, they're kind of anti-Trump and they're this and that, but they don't like the whole left establishment, or what the alt-right calls the cultural Marxist establishment.
Are you talking about the alt-left, or no? The more
no, it just reminded me of some things on the alt-left, and I was reading a interesting article. If I could bring it up, it's A-R-E-O, Aereo magazine. I don't know. I think they're a post-liberal position. They're not especially like Jacobin, but they kind of have points where one of their articles that was had a few days ago was called "How French Intellects, quote unquote, Ruin the West: Postmodernism."
Have read that article.
Yep, and that's from Eero magazine. And if you go on their front page, they have very critical about Trump, about this and that. They'll be like Charles Murray at Middlebury asking forbidden questions while leaving the road to bigotry, or political correctness versus Trumpism: why Trump is bigger threat to liberal values. So you could see there's this post-liberal thing. Or I like this one. The hijab needs informed reporting, not glorification or fear-mongering. So they want those values, but they don't want the social justice warrior or cultural Marxist outcome. And as we were saying before, that the SJW finds that, well, it's a corporation. You could do what you want, you know, this private corporation thing. And I feel as though that the whole SJW mentality is basically the normie person reacting to all these convoluted and hostile elites which are running the culture. And I really think that it's not so much a political thing. It's just normative people not understanding the world or something really strange.
Right.
I don't know.
And what's also ironic is that historically the left, as noted by formerly active online left-wing presence Freddie DeBoer, is that the left historically has regarded private oppression as just as serious as government oppression, and it's generally libertarians who believe that only the government can censor or oppress you.
Yeah, but the ACLU has traditionally taken up cases about corporate free speech, and where corporations have fired people because of their political views, but the left has completely changed on that issue. And that's sort of a new political realignment, where you're now seeing people on the alt-right calling for nationalizing Twitter and social media and Google on behalf of free speech. So on that issue, you are seeing like a realignment. And obviously people are not going to be intellectually consistent. People are going to they're going to look out for what's best for their own interest. And I'm not going to,
of course.
That makes sense. But it is interesting on that issue, there's a new political realignment. You also made the point in that article that this is a tremendous opportunity for a new political realignment in appealing to factions of the disaffected left. And a lot of these European nationalist parties like and figures like Marine Le Pen have taken these positions on, especially in economic issues.
Right, and what neoliberals and the cultural left have done to their peril is that they've essentially abandoned the cause of economic justice. And you see it through statements like Hillary Clinton's single payer will never, ever happen here, and other centrist liberals and Democrats who poo-poo economic justice and say that we just need to be realistic. And yet more and more Americans are clamoring for economic justice. The majority believe that the economy's rigged. The majority believe that the country's headed in the wrong direction. And as I mentioned before, the majority supports single-payer health care.
Were you saying that poll 40% of Republicans do even?
Oh, yes. And so if you're on the alt-right or dissident right, what you could do is you could champion the cause of economic justice. And that way you'd really put the left in a bind, because a lot of these brocialist types would look at the alt-right championing economic justice and they'll think to themselves, on the one hand, they embrace policies that are abandoned by the mainstream left, and on top of it, they don't even demonize us for being white. So, you know, why don't we throw in our lot with these guys as opposed to these mainstream cultural liberals?
What do you think about the argument that some right-wingers put out, that they say that socialized medicine and socialism in general can only work in a homogenous society? And they'll point out to like Bernie Sanders praising these homogenous countries that have socialism. And they'll say like America, the demographics make it impossible to have any kind of socialism. Do you have a rebuttal to that argument?
Oh, I do not have an especially good rebuttal to that argument, no. And what I will say is that if we were to implement socialist policies, we would need to combine that with very stringent immigration controls. And Richard Spencer actually cited Paul Krugman, who acknowledged that if you're going to offer universal health care and a robust social safety net, then you can't make that offer global, because then you have a tragedy of the commons kind of scenario. So if we are going to embrace economic populism, then that necessarily means immigration restriction.
And then there's also the argument about socialized healthcare as being too expensive, but the whole kind of Obamacare / Ryan Care model, that's actually a lot more fiscally unsustainable, because that's having the taxpayers subsidize the profits of insurance company, having like Medicare for maybe not everyone, but for people who can't afford health care. I mean, that's more fiscally responsible than Obamacare or Ryan Care.
Well, and as Spencer pointed out, you know, we already do socialize health care to an extent, in the sense that we socialize big insurance, because Obamacare really is just a huge giveaway to insurance companies. Either you're forced to pay for the premiums, or the government will give you some subsidies to help you pay for the premium. So either way, Uncle Sam is handing insurance companies money. And I think with single payer, what it would actually be cheaper and more efficient, because for one, you'd get rid of all of the administrative waste and bureaucracy. No more claim specialists, no more workers at doctor's offices whose sole job is to code services for certain insurance companies. None of that. And not to mention that time is money, and by getting rid of all of these insurance middlemen in a system where people can just visit the doctor when they need to, they'll have that peace of mind and they won't have to spend all of this extra time haggling with providers or insurance carriers.
So you're talking about complete nationalized healthcare, or you're talking about having like insurance companies as public utilities?
Well, complete nationalized, perhaps in the U.S. that might be a tall order, but at the very least, I do think that insurance companies like roads and other public goods should be public utilities, and we definitely need a much larger government role in healthcare, because pretty much every other first world country can somehow pull it off, so the U.S. with its obscene levels of wealth has no excuse.
Is the Swiss model of healthcare, I know a lot of political pundits are putting that out there, do they have health insurance as a public utility? I mean, obviously it's a lot better than what we have, or is it more the government just sets the prices?
Oh, that's not saying much. I don't know a whole lot about the Swiss model. Now, the only contrast that I have seen is that some people point to, say, the Dutch or Japanese models and claim that, see, look, they have private insurance and universal coverage at the same time, so we don't need single payer. But from what I've read, in those kinds of countries, they usually just have a few major carriers that are highly regulated. There aren't multiple insurance companies that are gaming the system, but I would have to conduct some more research into that matter.
Yeah, you're saying they have private insurance, but it's heavily regulated and controlled.
Oh, significantly regulated. And, as Dean Baker has mentioned, other countries also have patent monopolies for prescription drugs, but they also set price controls, and they don't just let Big Pharma charge whatever the hell they damn well please, the way they do here in the U.S. So that also helps keep costs down.
Conservatives will complain about these programs that like Medicare and Medicaid and Medi-Cal, how they're so expensive. But one of the problems is they're subsidizing these pharmaceuticals at the cost that the insurance that the pharmaceutical companies are putting out. If they were to subsidize them at capped rates. And I think there was Bernie Sanders was the one. Was he proposing that bill that would cap the rates? I mean, if that were to be put through, then these programs would be much more fiscally viable.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And in many ways, as much as conservatives decry socialized medicine and say it will raise our taxes, the horror, well, what are the excessive prices we pay for patented drugs, if not a form of taxation, or forbidding Americans from purchasing prescription drugs from Canada? That's a form of taxation because it's forcing us to pay more for essentially the same drugs. So I think people tend to be very myopic about this whole matter. Well, by people, I mean the libertarian beltway right.
You wrote an article, Tony Soprano versus the health insurance mafia. Can you talk about the episode you were referencing?
So, for those of you who don't watch The Sopranos, or for those of you who do watch the show, well, spoiler alert, but essentially, in one of the later seasons, Tony Soprano, the mob boss of a local New Jersey family, is shot and wounded by his deranged uncle and is sent to the hospital. And Tony does make a recovery, but eventually he is contacted by a representative from his insurance carrier. And you can just tell that she's trying to find out if he's okay, just so she can kick him out of the hospital, saying like, oh, all right, you're fine, you can leave now. And Tony, of course, is rankled by this, and his attitude is, you know, I've just barely recovered, I can barely take a dump, and, you know, I'm still hurting here, and, you know, it's shameful that I've paid so much in premiums to you over the years, and yet you're still trying to kick me out. And in many ways, it's true, and that's sort of shows how health insurance is not really like other forms of insurance, because you anticipate sometimes having to visit the doctor. I mean, I know that in Tony's case, it was an emergency, but he's basically for years paid health insurers for nothing. And yet when he needs their services the most, they look for ways to deny him coverage.
And you also talk about an experience you had as an working for an insurance brokerage firm.
Mm-hmm. And in many ways, that sort of taught me just how appalling this country's healthcare system really is, because like I said, mentioned in the post, the clients we were dealing with were primarily these prestigious, well-regarded tech firms that gave their employees very generous benefits. I mean, we're talking about...
Was it representing the companies or the insurance companies or the corporations that were doing business with them?
We were essentially advocates for the companies, well, more specifically, the employees of the companies. And whenever they had, say, a claim or an eligibility issue, we would help them resolve the matter. And what's crazy is that they had great benefits. You know, for employee-only plans, the employer would often pay for the entire premium, and more often than not, they only had at most a $20 copay for a regular office or specialist visit. And yet we still got bombarded by all of these complaints about, oh, this service isn't covered. You know, why is this doctor out of network, and how come the insurer won't reimburse me? And there was just a lot of unnecessary agony. And if this is coming from people who have good plans, I can only imagine what it's like for people with crappy, high deductible plans. So, as even though Obamacare has done a few good things, the real problem is this for-profit healthcare system where insurers basically make their money by denying you coverage. So you're not going to have universal coverage because it's going to conflict with the profit motive of big insurance.
With the replacing of Obamacare, I mean, obviously it's a bad bill, but do you think getting rid of it, just getting rid of it and leaving people with nothing would be a lot worse?
Well, yeah, I think that Obamacare is a step in the wrong direction and that it further privatizes healthcare. But at the same time, just eliminating Obamacare without a viable replacement will only compound the problem. So I think that we do need a legitimate alternative, and that Paul Ryan's proposed replacement was very ill-conceived. I also think that it's important for certain states, such as, say, California, to enact their own version of single-payer, because how did Obamacare become Obamacare? It first started off as RomneyCare in Massachusetts, which served as a model. So if other states were able to successfully implement single-payer and prove to the rest of the nation that, hey, it works, it doesn't kill jobs or render us some dysfunctional socialist dystopia, then more people might be inclined to push for single-payer on a national level.
What do you think about the whole issue if all hospitals were public? Obviously, the quality of care at public hospitals isn't that great.
Well, having never used a public hospital, I can't really speak to that. But, well, I don't think that public necessarily means deficient. It all depends on how it's regulated, funded, because I'm sure there are plenty of lousy private hospitals. So I admittedly, it was another area I would have to look more into.
Is there anything else about healthcare that we didn't get a chance to touch upon?
Well, I think we mostly covered it all, but I just think that it's past time that the U.S. joins the rest of the first world and removes this albatross that makes people's lives needlessly complicated and stressful.
Do most first world countries have some degree of a nationalized healthcare?
Well, they either have nationalized healthcare or, at the bare minimum, they have strict regulations and price controls. The U.S., on the other hand, just allows insurance carriers and big pharma to run amok.
I don't really know much about it, but accordingly, I mean, I can understand why, especially in today's environment, that there is a need for some kind of healthcare or some kind of form of maybe economic socialism, is because there seems to be a lot of people not only struggling, but it seems to be too much about socioeconomics, and that people go in these little pockets based upon culture and try to get jobs to make a certain amount of money to hang with a certain culture, but it ends up not working that way, and so you have a lot of displeasing people, and yeah, it's interesting. I find the whole economic thing, and I didn't really knew what Trump Care was about, and I still don't understand all the backings of the whole Obamacare thing, but it seems that socialism is certainly getting popular as the time goes on, is because depending what we're talking about, or, you know, it seems to be that if America was really based upon your freedoms, you know, why should you have this? I think like Rabbit was talking about the lame job, where it's like you could work at Blockbuster Video and then go home and still have time to do your art. Now it's like if you want to, quote unquote, career, you basically slave 50 to 60 hours selling glass to like door to door, right? And then you get beaten up and you're too tired, and you basically live this hellish corporate slavery. And it seems like that doesn't sound like freedom, and it sounds like you're slaving wage to get by, to get money, to do, you know, you don't have enough time to have freedom.
Right, exactly. And libertarians kind of have this very weird notion of freedom, where freedom simply means that the government won't throw you in the slammer for saying something critical. And I've heard some people, such as Isaiah Berlin, describe that as negative freedom. But in terms of positive freedom, where you actually have power over your own circumstances and you can actually live a dignified life, a fulfilling life, I'd say the U.S. is very subpar in that regard.
You have this article, Globalization and Designated Shitting Streets. Obviously, yes. The Shitting Streets, that's a reference to this kind of a meme about India. But you start off talking about the situation at UCSF, where they were outsourcing 49% of their IT jobs to India. And I guess kind of the joke of the article is, if we outsource enough of their jobs in basically United States, you'll see people just shitting in the street.
Well, just to clarify, I don't think that people are literally going to start shitting in the streets. I meant it more figuratively, in the sense that globalization essentially renders all of us disposable, and that we can just be cast aside like a bunch of shit, and that we're going to become one giant shopping mall full of deracinated, disempowered individuals. And what makes the UCSF case so appalling is that it's the first time that a public university like UCSF has actually outsourced jobs in that manner. And it just goes to show that even if people do everything right, they educated themselves, they acquired skills, they worked hard, they were loyal, and yet they were still given the boot when the university wanted to save some money. So who is safe nowadays, aside from, of course, these protected professionals that I mentioned in my review of Dean Baker's book?
And these people who, yeah, lost their job, they're not like your stereotype of these like working class rednecks. These are kind of people who are well educated, probably liberal, of like a wide variety of ethnic backgrounds.
Right. And one of the main people they quoted was actually an Asian American guy. So, you know, when people speak of globalization as this wonderful process that's enriching all these new people, and that it's just a bunch of whiny, sullen whites who are complaining about it, that's not necessarily true. Other groups suffer from globalization's ill effects as well.
I sent you that article from Steve Saylor about Malibu, and Malibu declaring itself as a sanctuary city, titled "Malibu, America's Least Welcoming City Declares Itself a Sanctuary City." And basically the premise of this is that these are some of the wealthiest people, and they want this cheap labor to exploit. At the same way, they also want a kind of virtue signal and show that they're like these great humanitarians. But in reality, the people working for them, like, you can read the stories, like, they take the bus from South Central, like, they get up at like 5 a.m. and drive 3 hours.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And Steve Saylor has other interesting points in this article. He said in Malibu, like, they blocked a Whole Foods, next to their city hall, and Barbara Streisand and Rob Reiner were involved in this referendum. But then what happened is the people there, they have their personal assistants drive up to Calabasas and bring them back food. I mean, Malibu's a nice place. Like, if you want to go, like, there's plenty of hiking. But, I mean, it's also not really ecologically sustainable. I mean, they're very anti-growth, and it's a very low population. I think the entire population is only 13,000. I mean, that's minuscule.
Which is peanuts.
Yeah, but they're also, the other thing is people have to drive in there, the workers. A lot of people commute to L.A., so it's not self-sufficient.
Right, and in many ways, these virtue signalers in Malibu are like these big corporate globalists who, on the one hand, get to benefit from cheap labor, but also virtue signal and feel good. Because you always see various apologists for neoliberal globalization say that, well, okay, perhaps American workers are losing jobs, but look at how much the fortunes of the global poor have improved. See, our business model is doing good. And the same thing for these Malibu residents. Even though they can continue exploiting cheap labor, they also get to feel virtuous because they're defending the poor brown immigrants from these mean, bigoted nativists. So they kind of want to have their cake and eat it too.
Yeah, I've actually heard some liberals defend outsourcing because it brings people like in India out of poverty.
Well, from more extreme poverty to less extreme poverty. But what's funny is how they rationalize the dispossession of regular middle class and working class white Americans, and as if somehow their recent suffering is morally justified by the fact that people in India now have jobs. You know, their attitude is, well, you got to bite a bullet and take one for the team. But of course, this ignores the fact that incomes for the obscenely wealthy have exploded. And yet no one's talking about the wealthy using their immense financial resources to better the lives of the world's poor. And in fact, the aforementioned Freddie DeBoer wrote an article called Outsource Brad DeLong. Brad DeLong being this pro-globalization economics professor at UC Berkeley. And what DeBoer essentially argues is that even though these people like Brad DeLong, Vox writers like Zach Buchamp, they always advocate globalization and say that it helps the world's poor and therefore it's virtuous, and yet you'll never see them fall on their own swords and outsource their own jobs. Funny how that works.
Yeah, as you're saying, they're advocating destroying the American middle class. And basically, even if that argument is true, that brings jobs to people, I mean, that's just like a drop of water in a bucket. Especially if you consider that, if you compare that to the amount of immense wealth that maybe, like, I've seen, I don't have the statistics on me, but I've seen statistics that say that the top 1% controls, like, almost pretty much like half of the world's wealth.
Right, and the eight wealthiest men, such as Bill Gates and Carlos Slim, they control more wealth than the bottom half of humanity combined. So, as DeBoer rightly pointed out, this narrative that...
Oh, so it's not the top 1%, you're saying just a small handful of individuals control...
Yeah, in many ways, it's even worse than just the 1%. We're talking the 0.001%.
You also have this article, Wahhabism and Globalism, and this also kind of ties into these topics.
Right, because I think one thing Dota told me in one of our private conversations is that a lot of the pathologies that we see nowadays are in many ways reactions against modernity and the forces of globalization. And the Islamic world is sort of confronting its own form of globalism, which is Wahhabism. Now, Wahhabism is basically this radical brand of Islam that originated in what we now call Saudi Arabia. And it basically believed that the only pure form of Islam was a kind of Islam practiced in medieval Saudi Arabia. And they seek to impose this brand of Islam on other Muslims. And if you look at the history of Wahhabism, their primary targets were not Christians or Jews or other non-Muslim minorities, but other Muslims who didn't conform to their radical form of Islam. For example, there was one incident where a bunch of Egyptian Muslims on their Hajj were harassed by the Wahhabis for carrying certain instruments that the Wahhabis thought were offensive. And then you also see the way Wahhabis are trying to establish a beachhead over in places like Indonesia. And even though Indonesia has always practiced a more lax, tolerant form of Islam, the Wahhabis want to remake Indonesian Islam in its own image. And in many ways, the Saudis' attempt to promulgate Wahhabism mirrors the Koch brothers and other libertarians' attempts to remake American politics by throwing money around.
You pointed out an interesting story about some, I think it was some pro-Palestinian group that was hijacked by Wahhabis, or was it Wahhabis?
Not exactly.
What happened is they kicked out this woman because she, for being pro-Assad. Was that the context?
What basically happened is that there's this independent Arab-American journalist named Rania Khalik, and she visited Syria last summer, I believe, and even though she is also critical of Assad, she tends to sympathize more with the Assad regime than the rebels, and she sees the rebels as being comprised mainly of these Wahhabi and jihadi fanatics who are intent on exterminating or subordinating minorities, because she's of a Druze background, so it's personal for her. And so when she criticized Wahhabism and Salafism, certain personalities on Twitter, like Khaled Beydoun, who writes for Al Jazeera, he accused her of being an Islamophobe, an Orientalist, and so did many others.
Would you
and
say so, Al Jazeera represents more Wahhabism or more kind of a neoliberal identity or a fusion of both?
Well, I'd say that Al Jazeera English represents more of a culturally liberal mindset. Just look at the way Hillary Clinton has received generous donations from Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states, and how the U.S., despite the fact that it waxes eloquent about democracy, seems to have no trouble propping up dictatorships like the Saudis. The U.S. is even supporting Saudi Arabia's savage war in Yemen.
So there was this journalist, Khaled Beydoun, who, he was the one who tried to get her blacklisted from speaking at this event?
Not necessarily. He didn't try to get her blacklisted, but there was basically pressure exerted on Students for Justice in Palestine at University of North Carolina, because various sectarian Sunni Arabs complained that Khalik was this Orientalist and Islamophobe, and that she was a Saudist. And so SJP at UNC decided that she was too politically toxic, and so they decided not to invite her, just to avoid controversy. But that doesn't mean that people like Khaled Beydoun necessarily agitated to have her appearance canceled.
You also make comparisons between the Hindus who support multiculturalism. What specific example were you referring to?
Well, in one of his articles, Dota linked to this old 2006 article, which I can't find now for some reason, where the author was talking about the Hindutva textbook controversy in California. Long story short, a bunch of Hindutva agitators were trying to revise history textbooks that downplay the Aryan invasion theory and downplay the caste system in India's history, and basically promote Hindutva propaganda. And the author made a very interesting point in that article. He said that whereas in India, Hindutvadis menacingly brandish their majoritarian might as a way of eliciting fearful compliance from minorities, here in the U.S., where they're the minority, they invoke the language of multiculturalism and tolerance and fairness. So it kind of is a kiss up and kick down strategy. You kiss up when you're the minority who's not yet powerful to brandish your strength, and then you kick down once you're powerful enough to disregard such appeals to tolerance and fairness.
Do you think that Islam in general should be viewed as an enemy or an adversary, or do you think it's more important to specifically single out Wahhabism with the same hostility that you would reserve for, say, neoliberals?
I definitely think that the focus should be on Wahhabism. And I remember 4 years ago, I wrote an article where I said that, you know, we really shouldn't indulge in Islamophobia or treat Muslims as this monolithic race. And Islam, in the grand scheme of things, really isn't the problem. And to the extent that it is a problem, it's more racial and ethnic in nature, i.e., Muslims who are Pakistani or Arab, or Arab causing problems in Europe. But I think that we should stand with Muslims who are being attacked by Wahhabis, because, like I said, these kinds of homogenizing globalization forces must be resisted at every turn. And that, just imagine if what would happen if Indonesia, the world's most populous Muslim country located in the Pacific, were to succumb to Wahhabism. The implications would be terrifying, so I think we need to nip this radical brand of Islam in the bud.
And what's the best way to address it with both our foreign policy and immigration policy, taking into account Trump's ban on different travel ban, but also our foreign policy, the countries we ally with in the Middle East?
Oh, I think our foreign policy is key. And another thing that Kolick has reported is that the U.S. essentially arms these jihadis to the tune of $1 billion a year in Syria alone.
I know Tulsi Gabbard did sponsor that bill to end that. Are you familiar with that bill?
Oh, yeah, the Stop Arming Terrorists bill. And I think it's absolutely necessary that this bill gets passed.
Yeah, that's going to be interesting. But the thing is, Trump did criticize Saudi Arabia in the primary, and especially the Clintons' ties to the Saudis. But now that he's in power, it seems to be like business as usual.
Well, yeah. I mean, like I said, since Donald Trump's a New York billionaire, he's only going to alter the status quo so much. And so, yeah, I still don't
regret voting for him, but I still have to point that out. I have to be consistent.
Oh, yeah. And I'm not trying to demonize people who did vote for Trump or say, "See, I told you so," in any way. I just think that we need to adjust our expectations accordingly.
Yeah, I mean, I voted for him with realistic expectations. I didn't vote for him.
Oh, of course.
I mean, I'll admit it, on election night, I did get a little bit, I got pumped up like a lot of people, but I had pretty realistic expectations.
Oh, yeah. And speaking of realistic, and to go back to the whole terrorist question or Wahhabi question, I think, one, we need to stop arming these jihadi groups. And also, as people like Tulsi Gabbard have pointed out, we need to address the root cause of the refugee crisis and other reasons why people from the Middle East are flocking to the West, because it's kind of crazy. It's okay to bomb these Muslim countries back into the Stone Ages, but if we don't want to admit them into our countries, then were horrible. And even certain progressives such as Jimmy Dore have highlighted this double standard. So, no, we need to stop the violence, or at the very least stop enabling the violence, and find a way to put out this fire that Bush and Obama lit in the Middle East.
You also wrote about refugees and white South Africans.
Mm-hmm. Well, basically, I kind of wrote the post as a bit of a thought experiment, and it would be very interesting to see how the usual suspects on both sides would react if white South Africans suddenly became refugees. And
there
I suspect
that proposal, I had him on the show. He's from Brazil, Rodrigo Serros de Campos. He put out that petition and he did get media coverage from the mainstream media.
What exactly was his petition? I'm not familiar
to
with
grant
his work.
Right of return of white South Africans. I think it was specifically to Europe, the same way Jews have right of return to Israel.
Yeah, I certainly wouldn't be opposed to that. And how could the left object? After all, they're always saying that immigration is this unalloyed good that never possibly harms natives. So how can they object? And if they did object, that would be most telling.
Recently, the government in South Africa has proposed confiscating white-owned land. And then many people have been saying that there is impending genocide.
Well, I don't know how serious the ANC actually is about confiscating white-owned land. I do know that Jacob Zuma and other South African elites have been plagued by corruption scandals and that they're losing legitimacy. And so I think they're trying to race bait as a means of sort of claiming a populist mantle. But, well, whether or not it amounts to genocide, I can't say for certain, but I definitely do think that white South Africans are in a beleaguered state. And if it does escalate, then we certainly should consider granting them refugee status.
And just a lot of people want to leave just because of the crime and the lack of economic, just the economic situation. I mean, there's rich people there living in like gated compounds. But then there's like the farmers that are, a lot of them are getting killed. So yeah, I mean, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, and as I kind of jokingly proposed near the end of the post, well, half jokingly, you know, we could have a trade. All of the refugees from Africa who've flocked to Europe can take the whites' place in South Africa, and everyone wins. There will be more demographic equilibrium in both lands, and, you know, immigrants always bring diversity and enrichment, so how can the South Africans possibly object? And they'll no longer have to deal with white people.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny you mentioned that, because what would probably happen, I mean, the white South Africans who would go to, say, Europe or United States, I mean, they would be pretty, they'd basically integrate into American culture or European culture. But if, hypothetically, those refugees from Africa were to go to South Africa, you'd probably see inter-African conflict, which actually has happened. I was reading that illegal immigrants from other parts of Africa are going to South Africa because it's more prosperous, relatively speaking. And there actually has been, like, black-on-black anti-immigrant riots.
Right. And what's so funny is that whenever you see people analyze the situation in South Africa, they'll deplore the xenophobia on one hand, but they'll also sort of admit that the influx of foreigners puts a strain on jobs and results in increased competition. It's like, what? More workers means increased competition? Who would have thought? And yet somehow they can never put two and two together when analyzing immigration to Western countries.
So do wasabiist Indians, Trump care, do they all take a shit in the street, or I don't know. China.
I think a good way to conclude this show would be to talk about how all of these problems that we've discussed have to do with the strains caused by globalization and how it's sort of uprooting traditional communities and sort of rendering us a more alienated, atomized species in many ways.
So basically, I mean, all these issues are connected together.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And without trying to sound too much like a commie, I do think that, as some people on the far left are correct to point out, lot of this has to do with the crisis of global capitalism, and especially in the United States, where this relentless pursuit of profit is really destroying our traditional communities. And some people on the alt-right have even noted that a lot of the enemies of their people and their causes are these big corporations like Facebook and Twitter. And they said, you know, why should we keep defending corporations when they continue to promote these culturally liberal values? And so
yeah,
I think that,
I mean, like the alt-right, they like to use the term cuck, and primarily in a racial sense, but you could say that the new cuck is like a conservative that supports the economic interest of their enemies. That's the new cuck.
Right. And I just think that at some point, if the alt-right and the right in general wants to survive and even thrive, I really do think they need to stop apologizing for corporate capitalism, and they need to stop defending the rich. And so I really think they need to...
Who do you mean specifically? Because Richard Spencer is pretty much the main figure on the alt-right, and Greg Johnson, too. They're pretty much on the same page as you economically.
Right, and I think this is also a generational thing, because I think I mentioned before that Jared Taylor, who used to dominate the white nationalist alt-right scene, he always struck me as a little more libertarian leaning, or at the very least, he doesn't really address economics. So I think that with more millennials coming into the movement, you're going to see more of an economic focus. And I think there should be a focus, not just occasionally discuss economics, but it should be one of the main themes, and how, you know, so-called cultural Marxism and SJWism and neoliberal global capitalism, how they're all intertwined. And I think that's more of a winning message than the obsessive HBD style focus that you see some alt-righters indulge in.
And yeah, I think another trend I see with younger people I've had on the show, I can't speak with basically all millennials, but I've noticed based on people I've talked to, is people over the age of 40, they have a stronger emotional attachment to either a conservative identity, whether it's to Reagan or traditional conservatism, or if they're liberals, they have a strong connection to like the 60s counterculture left. But I've noticed with people in their 20s, people in their 20s and even 30s, they're less interested in political labels, and you see more a trend of political fusionism.
Right, and in many ways, since millennials are living paycheck to paycheck, can't afford homes, and are just struggling to get by, they can't really afford to be too particularly purist when it comes to their politics, aside from a certain minority of coddled college kids. And so in many ways, when we approach politics, we sort of think of it from the standpoint of, is it good for us? And so we're less tethered to these abstractions and rigid ideological categorizations than, say, older Randroid types.
We are at the end of the show. I would like to thank Bay Area Guy for being on. It's been an excellent show.
Yeah, it was a great conversation, and thanks for having me.
And also, thanks, Pilliter.
It's nice talking to you all, like always.
Yep, always. Let's do it again.